Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation Policy Committee for this Thursday, March 14th. I'm Representative Hornstein. Finance, sorry. I was in policy till midnight last night, and so, correct the record, the Transportation Finance Committee for this March 14th. And we have three bills on the agenda, and all of them relate to bonding. So this is going to be for informational purposes only, and all three of these bills will be added to our docket that we consider for recommendation to the bonding committee, the Capital Investment Committee. So we'll take Representative Newton's bill first. Now, more information, more Highway 10. We're hearing a lot about Highway 10, so, and I know that you have Mr. Fisher back as well. So welcome to the committee, Representative Newton.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing our bill. I'm looking around to see if Representative Mahoney is here.
Yeah, so Representative Mahoney will have an opportunity to further amplify his comments from yesterday. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps Mr. Mahoney would like to introduce the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Where do we have a quorum?
Mr. Chair, what this bill does is it expands to three lanes, Highway 10 from the Hanson Bridge, where we last widened the highway, to the Round Lake Boulevard area. It's a $30 million estimated budget. We have three bridges that are involved. Those bridges have already been accommodated or are set to accommodate three lanes. And I know this year that Highway 10 in that same area is going to be doing some repaving. So I don't anticipate that we're going to get the funding for it this year, but it's part of an ongoing project. So I think, is Mr. Fisher here?
Yes.
Doug. I'd like to have Mr. Fisher, the county engineer for Anoka County, to testify.
Welcome back, Mr. Fisher. Good to see you, as always.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Fisher. I'm the Anoka County Highway Engineer, and there is a handout that I just got here. Unfortunately, as it is with Highway 10, if there's a snowflake on the highway, things slow down quite a bit. So I apologize for rushing in here like I did. But Highway 10 in Coon Rapids, as Representative Newton stated, is a deficient highway. This is kind of the east end of the section we talked a little bit about yesterday. And taking a cue from yesterday, I won't have the big long PowerPoint presentation for you, Mr. Chair. The nice thing about this section of highway is over the years, as you see on the handout that's going around, between the city and the county and the state, we have already improved the interchanges. Most of the old interchanges could only have a four-lane highway underneath, but the Hanson Boulevard, Main Street, Round Lake Boulevard, we have upgraded all of these at a considerable local expense to upgrade these interchanges so they can receive six or eight lanes even of highway underneath. So the interchanges, for the most part, are all set for the expansion. We just need that expansion to occur. If you're I always like to kind of put this road in perspective. If you're a fan of Joe Souchere and the Garage Logicians on the radio, this is affectionately known to his crew as the Redneck Bottleneck. We don't like to perpetuate that stereotype, but that is the road we're talking about, and it will be one of those highways that will be on everybody's all the traffic forecasters. Notices they always have to comment on this stretch of Highway 10. So we would support doing this, or MnDOT doing this. And again, unlike a lot of the other Adelaide projects around the Beltway that have been done at very high expense, because the interchanges are set for this, we think this can be done at a lower expense. And just like MnDOT's project proposed on 494 up in the northwest part of the metro, the Maple Grove, a managed shoulder, where during peak hours the shoulder, you know, we'd even feel that a managed shoulder on this could be another low-cost, effective way to add capacity during the peak hour at a lower than regular cost. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll close my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. And Mr. Fisher, I appreciated your last comment because we actually just passed in the policy committee yesterday or the day before. It's all meshing together. I think the day before, the expanded MnPass authority for 35E. And I remember your slide from yesterday where you talked about Highway 10 being kind of the 35E of the northwest suburbs and the 35W of the south. So that was actually a pretty effective graphic. So
thank you.
The idea of a managed lane is actually a very sound one, and appreciate your mentioning that. Members, do you have any questions of Mr. Fisher or Representative Newton? Yeah, Representative Dean.
So just to be clear, the $30 million is for adding a lane, but you also said that a managed shoulder is a possibility as well, or am I conflating those two things into one?
Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, that would be an option. We have had a discussion with the MnDOT Metro District staff about that. Right now there's a 10-foot shoulder. You know, if that 10-foot shoulder could become a 14 or 16-foot managed lane with the proper electronics for lane on-off, you know, that could be. And again, instead of, you know, that would decrease the cost of adding a lane and a shoulder, just converting the existing shoulder into a managed lane, we feel would be a reasonable option, reasonable low-cost option.
Okay, and we have Representative Bernardi, and just so everyone can prepare, Representative Mahoney after that.
Okay,
Representative Bernardi.
I didn't share this yesterday, and I do want to share it today, just to give perspective, and people are used to traveling on different roadways, but we do have a cabin out of town, and we can go Highway 10 or 94, and we always used to go Highway 10 a number of years ago, but we don't go that way anymore because it's less, can you believe it? It's less congested going out at 94 than it is on 10. So I just wanted to share that it's really, the congestion has been growing immensely over the years.
Mr. Chair, if I may interject just for a moment. As housing is starting again, you know, at one time, and I remember when we were working with North Star Corridor, we were showing that the Highway 10 corridor was the fastest growing corridor in the state, and it was the third fastest in the United States. And as housing starts to pick up again, we're going to see that same thing with development between Minneapolis and St. Cloud continuing on Highway 10. So I think it makes it imperative that we move sooner on this than faster than later. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Newton. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've already had a couple of conversations with people up in a person up in Anoka today, so I'm sure. You know, the understanding, the conversations I'm sure will progress for a while. I have a couple of things, actually. One question and then a comment. I'm looking at the map. You have a blue MnDOT add a lane, and then you have a green section. Which section are we talking about, or are we talking about both of them? And then you have a red section. So. Is one done, one proposed, and one hoped for, or are they all done? What?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the blue section is done. It was done in 2009 with great success. That has made a tremendous improvement, but the section in green is still the freeway section that's four lane. Again, and all those orange squares you see are overpasses or interchanges, and they have now all been upgraded to receive that additional widening of the highway below. So it's the green section that we're asking for in this bill by Representative Newton.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, so then at a later date you're coming back for another section to the north of this, you know, north of 4th Avenue, is it?
7th.
Yes. Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the rest of Highway 10 through the cities of Anoka and Ramsey are the non-freeway sections where we have those accurate signals, and that's subsequent.
That was
projects.
Yesterday?
That was yesterday.
All right. and all this work would be done prevailing wage, correct?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes. The road and bridge, at the highway department, all our road and bridge projects, because they have a combination of federal, state, and local money, will still require prevailing wages. And Representative Mahoney, I'd also like to comment that the Anoka County Highway Department, my department that I oversee and run, is more than half represented by members of the International Union of Equipment Operators, Local 49, and I'll stand my workforce up against any workforce in the country. We do an excellent job. We've won national and local awards for the service that they provide, and I'm very proud of my
Mr. Chair.
Good answer.
By that particular statement, I would suspect that you would never call them lazy, correct?
No, sir.
Mr. Chair, and then just one other comment, and I'll be done. In Never this morning's up. Paper, you know, here's kind of the problem that we are all facing. You know, the counties north of you were, in the last census before, were the fastest growing counties in America, some of them. This year they are not even, I think, in the top 20. The report just came out, I think, yesterday, and it's in the paper today. That is going to be a problem for us as we try to figure out where to allot money. So, you know, we'll have to follow where the demographics are going. I've got some space in Lower Town. Thank you.
Okay, are there any further questions or comments, discussion of House File 671? Hearing none, we'll include this in our docket for further consideration in terms of bonding recommendations. And with that, we'll conclude this bill on our informational hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for all of your testimony over the last couple of days. Anoka County. Okay, our next bill, by the way, I do believe we have a quorum. So let's, we have some minutes before us, and this is from yesterday's meeting.
Mr. Chair, I've been looking at the minutes, and I'd like to move them for you.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Mahoney moves the March 13th minutes. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Our second bill today is House File 793, Representative Murphy. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And just to review again for you, on these bonding bills, we hold, this has been the custom since I've been here, at least 10 years. The Transportation Finance Committee will hold an informational hearing on the bonding request. We'll have a discussion about it, and then we create a docket where we rank the various projects, and then we send those on to Representative Houseman. So even though we won't be taking action on it, this is your chance to shine.
Thank you.
And then, of course, you can always follow up with members of the committee and talk about what a wonderful project this is and why we should rank it number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the time that you are giving to us. In 2009, we also had projects, and we decided to combine, instead of individual projects, combine our interests. The Rail Authority people that are here decided to collaborate and ask for a lump sum, which would cover several projects. Personally, I'm most interested in the Northern Lights Express, but in order to get that, we have to have some other projects down here in the geographically metropolitan area. And so that is why 793 is asking for a lump sum for capital investments to initiate planning and authorize and fund projects that merit funding from the United States Department of Transportation. And Mr. McDonough from Ramsey County and Bob Mazzaline from St. Louis County are parts of their rail authorities, and they can give more details to you than I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Jim McDonough, Ramsey County Commissioner, and I chair the Ramsey County Regional Rail Authority, and I also represent Ramsey County on the Minnesota Passenger Rail Forum. And that's been the vehicle that the Minnesota Department of Transportation has pulled together with all the stakeholders in Minnesota for passenger rail and freight rail to initially help Minnesota form the state rail plan, both for passenger and freight rail, and then to help formulate and help us prepare in the original $26 million that was allocated a few years ago to be prepared for opportunities that came forward to advance the state rail plan, and that's worked quite successfully. We're pleased that there's a bonding request for $26 million more. I'm here to talk about a couple of those specifics, but I really want to emphasize, and I couldn't emphasize more, that this partnership that MnDOT has pulled together of all the stakeholders, I believe, has worked quite well for us to be not only to advance a state rail plan, both for freight and passenger rail, to be prepared for those opportunities and help invest in that infrastructure as we move forward here. And I do believe, I think MnDOT actually received an award for that format of pulling together the partners and stakeholders and helping not only bring to the state rail plan, but help allocate the dollars that came afterwards. A couple of projects I want to highlight that were funded with the past money, but then also we'll be looking to use in the potential future dollars here, was Union Depot, and I know many of you were there December 8th when we had the grand opening of that. So $13 million of that $26 million actually came forward to help leverage over $120 million of federal money, over $50 million of local money, to have that intermodal hub for passenger rail, light rail, Council Transit buses. Jefferson is operating out of there now, and that's a good system there, that intermodal hub to bring all that transit system together. And so for $13 million in state bonding, we've leveraged over almost 10 times that in federal dollars, about over five times of that in local dollars, so I think that's a pretty good return on investment. And that was last money and to really help make that project go. One of the main corridors that Ramsey County has been participating in is the part of the Midwest High Speed Rail Initiative. It's the Twin Cities to the Chicago line. I can recall when there was some high speed rail money a few years back in Chicago when Administrator Zabel was talking about being prepared to apply for that money, and he said in Minnesota or in the United States, high speed rail, a lot of times it's not about how fast you go, but how often you don't go slow. And so in this corridor between Chicago and the Twin Cities, a lot of that investment is the incremental investment we can make, in particular in Minnesota between the Twin Cities and La Crosse, the ACT rate crossings, the separation there, the signalization. So some of these bonding dollars can help in investments right now that benefit freight and passenger rail. 5% of the nation's freight travel in that corridor right now. I don't think a lot of people realize that. And that has a big impact on commerce in this state and in the nation. So Ramsey County has been very supportive of not only the process, but the investment that the state has been willing to make in rail, and we're supportive of the $26 million request. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll now stand for any questions now or afterwards.
Well, thank you, Commissioner McDonough, and I just wanted to personally thank you for your work, not only with CTIB and Ramsey County, but particularly on the Union Depot. I was fortunate enough to go to the ribbon cutting last December, and I don't know how many members have been down there, but it's a very impressive facility and already in use, and I understand more. The Amtrak will be coming through there, what, by the end of the year? What's the timeline? When is Amtrak going to be moving from the Transfer Avenue or Transfer Road station down to the Union Depot?
Monday, we just had good news from a conference call with FRA dealing. The bureaucracies is sometimes very difficult. We would have hoped that they would be there by now, but early fourth quarter of this year, Amtrak should be operating there. We're ready for them now. It's difficult because three freights operate on that main line there. And so to be able to bring passenger rail into the Union Depot and get them back up by the early third, fourth quarter of this year, they'll be there. We're ready for them, and they're excited to be there. Okay. And we're working on a second trip with PennDOT.
How did you know my next question?
And we're, that study's advancing right now. The numbers look very good. Many of you don't know, in the summer, the this is one of Amtrak's, the high ridership for Amtrak is at all-time high system-wide. But on the Empire Builder, which is the line that comes through St. Paul, is at an all-time high. But just the segment from St. Paul to Chicago, in the summer, they actually add coaches in St. Paul when they stop to pick up riders because the ridership between St. Paul and Chicago is so high. So the numbers look really good. MnDOT is working with WISDOT, Wisconsin Department of Transportation, and Amtrak and FRA on the second daily trip right now.
Okay. Great. And do you know, Commissioner McDonough, when some kind of a decision or plan would be in place? Like, what would the timeline be if things were to move at the rate you would like them to? When would we, when do you think at the earliest, Mr. Kroll might know.
Dan's much more up to speed on that study than
I don't want to digress too much, but members, this is important, and we haven't talked much about passenger rail yet in the committee, and this whole Amtrak thing is intriguing to me. So, Mr. Kroll, welcome to
the committee. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dan Kroll. I'm director of MnDOT's Passenger Rail Office. The work with Amtrak on a second builder train is progressing. We're hoping to have the results. We were hoping to have them by February, but working with the freight railroads, we've had to add in some additional capacity modeling work, which is pushing us back to the end of July, August. And from that, we'll have recommendation, cost estimates, ridership estimates on what it would take to add a second train.
Okay, and so and then of more interest perhaps to the committee, Mr. Kroll, what would the state expenditure be, or would there be state expenditure for that, and is that covered in House File 793?
Mr. Chair, members, there is an estimate of what the engineering work would take to accommodate a second train. I think we put in $3-4 million out of that 26 for that work.
Okay.
In the recommendation. And that's not including the capital. We don't know if it'd be a turnkey operation, if Amtrak would supply the equipment or so on. That will come out of the recommendations in the study.
So then last question that I have, maybe there's other, I see there's others, Mr. Petersburg. Mr. Kroll, so assuming then you know, the best case scenario, when do you think that we could see that second train stopping at Union Station?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, under the passage of PREA, which is the Passenger Rail Investment Improvement Act of 2008, Congress said that services such as this are corridor trains. They're not part of Amtrak's national system. So any local cost would be local cost to supplement a fare box return for that. We do not have a funding source right now for operations, maintenance, contracting of services. So that would have to be addressed by the legislature before we could look at service. So idealistically, if we had funding in place, it could be at less than 2 years.
Thank you for that. And then the sequence is the study results, then you come up with some numbers, financing numbers, then presumably come back to the legislature, maybe even some local entities, and a funding package is developed from there.
Mr. Chair, correct.
Okay. All right, thank you. So we have, actually, I understand Mr. Representative Earhart had a question, then Mr. Petersburg.
Well, I have two, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering what happened to Leon Chins that was in depot down there. Is it still there? Or? a nice little restaurant down there.
I haven't been there for a few years. Commissioner, you want to take that? What happened to Leanne?
I thought you were just in there. That's why I was asking you.
No, when I was on the Met Council, I went there.
Leanne Shins has moved on but expanded throughout the metropolitan area, but is no longer in Crystals. But there's a great Greek restaurant called Crystals, which is full for lunch every day, and they're lined up. And I would encourage anybody, if they haven't been to the Union Depot, to go at lunch and enjoy a great Greek lunch down there. They have a great buffet at a very reasonable price.
Transportation Finance Committee neither endorses nor I don't whatever the disclaimer is.
Mr. Chair, okay. I want you to know that it's not even in his district that he said that about it.
Okay. I'm Representative Peters.
But wait, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, one more, sorry.
I wanted to ask, are you getting cooperation from Wisconsin on the type of things that you're trying to do here? I mean, there was a few moments there when Governor Walker was in charge, and I think he did away with all rail within sight. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative, with the second daily train, we are working with Wisconsin DOT and a La Crosse Area Planning Agency is funding that as well. What Secretary Gottlieb of the Wisconsin DOT stated to us in a letter 2 years back was Wisconsin's going to stay focused on the existing passenger rail services that has served them well for 20 years, and that's the Hiawatha, the Milwaukee, Twin Cities Leg, and Empire Builder. They aren't engaged with us when we're looking at the high-speed services along the same corridor.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman, and this may show my little bit of my inexperience in regards to this particular area, but it seems like this bill is a fairly broad appropriation without much specificity to it, which seems unusual compared to most of the bills that we have for bonding. And it sounded like at least there was some sort of priority there, and I'm wondering is there at least a priority of or schedule of anticipated expenditures for this that we could get, because it does seem like we're diverging from the normal direction.
I had a feeling that Representative Houseman would want to comment on that. Representative Houseman, Chairman Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking to see whether it was here because I was given a very specific one. I was given a two-year, and it said the first year they would need $20 million and then the remainder the second year, and there were very specifically all the projects listed in their dollar amount. So for some reason, I know that's available, but I don't know if somebody in the room has it, but it would seem to be a helpful one to distribute to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Passenger Rail Forum based their recommendation to the commissioner for this bill on projects that the department identified. Roughly, I have the list. Roughly, and keep in mind that $26 million was a general appropriation that allowed us to be opportunistic and incremental. And what was intended when the $26 million was identified isn't how the funding actually shook out because of projects moving at different paces. Union Depot is a prime example of that. But what we're estimating for this is the Twin City to Milwaukee High Speed Corridor, about $3 million for 13 and 14. Northern Lights Express, final design and engineering work, approximately $5 million. Rochester Zip Rail Corridor, approximately $3 million. Second daily train to Chicago, approximately $5 million for the engineering design and construction. And other corridor development system projects as we move into different environmental stages, we have different levels of work that's necessary. We estimated $4 million. So for 13 and 14, we're looking at 20, and then for 15 and 16, there's an additional $6 million for those projects. The issue is we need to have the funding identified before we can leverage any federal funding if it's available. And as an example, there will be another round of Tiger applications, Tiger grant funds that these projects are eligible for. If you don't have matching funds, you can't apply for them.
Thank you. We have a couple more questions. Mr. Grohl, if you can maybe provide that in writing to the committee, that would be helpful. I think that's what Representative Petersburg was getting to. The only man on this committee who has professionally rode the rails, Representative Beard's got the next question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. There were comments about our neighbors in Wisconsin I wanted to address, if I could. I am one of the legislative ambassadors or appointees to the Midwest Interstate Passenger Rail. It's a long a long phrase. The acronym is easier to say. I can't even keep the number straight. And I serve on there with our staff member, Mr. Crom. And so we get to rub shoulders with our Wisconsin friends. Before you get the impression that Republican governors are anti-rail, you should know that Mr. Walker also approved a $32 million expenditure to buy some more freight rail tracks in southern Wisconsin, and assisted, I think it was a transaction between Union Pacific and a Minnesota company in buying 60-some miles of track north of Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls in the sand country. They know where rail actually makes sense and has a fast impact on economic development, and they're not afraid to put their money there. I know we have the Mercy program, folks, and we should probably take a lesson from our Wisconsin friends. The high-speed rail is quite another deal. It's not even passenger rail. We're talking about expanding Amtrak conventional rail capacity to Chicago, a discussion that might merit some further probing, I think. But high-speed rail, the costs go up exponentially once you get above about 80 or 90 miles an hour, and that becomes the problem. 110 miles an hour, they go up by even more geometric factors. And I think it's only a prudent decision that some governors in the Midwest made when they said, you know, 90, 100, that's a pretty good speed. We can probably afford that, but going over 110 and approaching 200, the dollars go up exponentially. The return on passenger savings and time go down very small increments. And so I think there's a lot more to be said about that other than just a broad political sway. But some people not liking trains, because there's a lot to like about trains, and they have their place. Having said that, may I ask Mr. McDonough just one question?
Of course.
We've got about $250 million tied up in the St. Paul Union Depot. It looks magnificent. It is quite an impressive structure. What is our plan for that end of St. Paul, and how many more buildings are we going to have to rebuild at that kind of expense before we start seeing something, or what do we want that to be other than a bus hub?
Well, currently, Commissioner McDonough, as I pointed out, Metrotransit is using it as their hub.
Yes.
So there's over 300 buses there right now every single day. Jefferson is using it as their hub. Mm-hmm. Central Corridor will open up in July of 2014, and light rail will be there every single day. I don't recall how many stops in there every single day. And then as the transit system builds out, Riverview Corridor, Rush Lane Corridor, Gateway Corridor, that all will come into that. So this is a long-term investment. This is one of these 100-year investments for the community. It's also used every day for multitudes of events. It's a part of the community. It's used more than just a transit hub. It was intended to be more than just a transit hub. So it's one of these things that certainly, as it's opened up, it was been used since day one as a transit hub, and it's intended to grow as a transit hub. There's a multitude of things that have gone on since the day we made that investment. I think your committee last year was there, and I pointed out to you that, you know, right across the street, the for sale, for lease on that building. That building is totally filled up and leased out and sold. The post office just announced that a private developer has bought that building right next door and is going to invest in built 250 market rate rental, apartment rentals right next door, where that building has been on the market for over 6 years with no takers. Right on the directly east of that is an empty parking lot that's been sitting empty for, God, 20 years or so, and there's a interest from a private investor to do 65 market rate apartments there. So these public investments and like this do stimulate the confidence in the private market, so there's that tangible thing. So these investments take time, there's patience, but I believe they're going to pay off. They're already paying off today, right now, and tomorrow, and next year, from a year from now, we'll see greater payoff, and a year from now, we'll see greater payoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Benson, then Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that there's $3 million in monies towards the Zip Rail project in Rochester. Help me understand, there is a study already in progress on a feasibility and economic study. So does this money get allocated even if, you know, we got some time frame here? What if the economic study says that a high-speed rail between Greenfield project, high-speed rail between Rochester and the cities is far too expensive? We've got $3 million that we're going to spend anyway. Can you help me understand that?
Mr. Crom.
Representative, we have conducted three other studies in the past that were done before there was a federal rail program, a passenger rail program. This study is the first one since the federal government passed PREA, as I mentioned, and became aggressive in implementing passenger rail throughout the country. What we're doing right now is a feasibility study in terms of identifying alignments, potential ridership, markets, and then connections and facilities along the corridor. that work should be done middle of next year, and we'll have a sense then of moving forward. And that's what the additional request is for, is to move in then to the Tier 1 preliminary environmental work that needs to take place.
Representative Benson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, but so it sounds to me like we're already presuming that it's going to be the green light to do that. I have some real problems with a bonding bill that assumes before we know, and this is a bonding bill potentially that could end up this year, and we won't even know until the end of next year or the middle of next year what that study is going to show. So I just think that as we make recommendations to the bonding bill out of this, that we at least consider some of these things.
The process always has a no-build alternative in every corridor we're working on. And as I mentioned before, as we've been implementing the various parts of the adopted state rail plan, we've been trying to be incremental and opportunistic. And where one project goes a different direction than we may have intended in the plan, we have to be flexible to adjust to that. We're anticipating that it will prove to be feasible, and we will need those funds to leverage federal money to continue the development of the corridor.
Before we get to the next question, I wanted to give a warm Transportation Finance Committee welcome to the 7th grade students at Dodge Middle School. So welcome. And but just so you know, we're hearing a bill now about passenger rail. So, and we have been talking a little about the new Union Depot in downtown St. Paul, which is a very interesting place to visit if you have a chance. Representative Houseman, you're next on the list.
I just wanted to follow up one more to Representative Beard's question. Representative McDonough might want to tell the committee when Amtrak will move to Union Depot.
Thank you, Representative Houseman. And we did talk about that a little bit earlier. We just had a conference call earlier in the week with FRA and Amtrak and the Freights, and we feel very confident after that call that early in the fourth quarter, at September timeline, we'll have Amtrak up and running. But it's been a difficult process. Getting FRA, three freight railroads aligned with Amtrak on making that one. But we're ready for them the day that we can get all those stars along.
Thank you. It will be
this year.
Thank you. And I have one final question. Relates a little bit to Representative Benson's question. And I see Mr. Ungaro is hiding back there. And I had a nice visit up in Duluth in December, and I had a tour of some of the transit infrastructure, and we went out actually to the county's road shed, or I don't know what the official title is, but I saw a lot of equipment there. But I was very impressed with what Duluth is doing to construct a multimodal station up there. Not quite as big and grand as the Union Station, but this is a place where potentially the NLX will come in, a lot of the Duluth Transit Authority buses, et cetera. Very good multimodal hub. And I've been really encouraging Rochester to take a look at doing something like that in anticipation of either the zip line, but even prior to that, hopefully some Amtrak service in Rochester heading to Chicago on existing corridor. Do you have, is there any thought that you're giving to, in this bill, House File 793, towards supporting some of this infrastructure in other parts of Minnesota that are anticipating rail, primarily Rochester? Has that been given thought? Because it seems like you've got to have a station like this in place in order to receive these trains. And there's really, even for buses, very little infrastructure in Rochester. So I don't know if that's come up. Is it just, am I the only one thinking of this? We had a good conversation, Representative Benson, about that. But any thought about a multimodal station in Rochester, is that been on anyone's radar?
Mr. Chair, as part of the rail plan, we have identified facilities that support are needed for each of the corridors, facilities along the NLX, facilities in Rochester, the use of the facility in St. Paul. There's investments being made at Minneapolis Transportation Interchange as the West Metro station for service. We're looking at better utilization of some of the stations potentially on the corridor to St. Cloud, along using North Star stations. So that type of infrastructure, along with maintenance and operating facilities are part of all these corridor projects that are identified in the plan.
Okay. Well, I'm going to huddle a little with Representative Benson because he's given me some ideas here. But Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I'm not mistaken, the federal government helped make a determination that the river route was the preferred route and the most efficient route and so on. So we've had little or no discussion regarding any Amtrak passenger rail that would come through Rochester for quite some time. My concern with putting all our eggs in one basket with Zip Rail that would run between the two is it doesn't account for any future potential for Amtrak between Chicago and the Rochester market. And indeed, we have no facilities. We've even caused the chairman of this committee to walk a mile and a half to catch I think it was a Jefferson line, if I'm not mistaken, to downtown Mayo because we don't have a facility.
But it was a beautiful day, and it's a wonderful city. Yeah, so I absolutely, it's absolutely. The PED. It was PED Transit, Representative Fornati.
But so my concern is we're plowing ahead with, we don't have a study that's completed. We're going to spend another $3 million. I would like to have just a whole lot more discussions around that, and have a real comprehensive study that ties this all together, and that's my concern.
Great. Commissioner McDonough.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make one more comment, and it was really a follow-up to Representative Beard's comment about what's happening at Union Depot, and it does get brought up a lot, but when MetTrans can bring over 300 buses to Union Depot, they can actually drive efficiencies in their system because they're not dropping off people on a corner anymore for transfers. They're taking them to an intermodal hub with amenities, and they have an option of more than just one bus that would come before at that corner to pick them up and take them somewhere. Now they've got an option of multiple places they can go. So Met Council can really take a look at their whole system and actually drive efficiencies within their whole bus system because they have an option with this intermodal hub. So there's these tail benefits that really help drive efficiencies in the system. We don't talk about that a lot, but it really is one of these bigger benefits when you invest in these intermodal hubs. I think that's why it's important, to the chair's point, that as you take a look at throughout the system, that these intermodal hubs, whether it's in Duluth, St. Cloud, or Rochester, how critical they're going to be to the build-out of these systems.
Thank you. That's great. I appreciate that comment. Okay. Concluding comments, Representative Murphy, as we wrap up.
Mr. Chair, you know where I live. Up north, far away, over 2.5 to 3 hours away. Mr. Mazzolin has come down to.
Oh, okay. I didn't have his name on the list. Sorry about that.
And to testify about our project and/or the continuation, and I would hate for him to come all the way down without.
Absolutely, yeah. I did not have him on the list.
Some statements.
Okay, absolutely. Welcome to the committee, and I apologize. I didn't have you down here, so I know that there was another testifier coming that's sick, and so I hope we'll get the northern perspective from you. So, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and representatives, thank you for having me here. Bob Manzolin with the St. Louis and Lake County Regional Rail Authority. Also working on the NLX intercity passenger rail project between Duluth and Minneapolis. Some kind words were said by you, Mr. Chair, about the depot in Duluth. We're also working, I don't think anyone's really touched on the other projects involved with the former bond appropriation that was set aside for the passenger rail improvement projects within the state. I'd just like to touch on a couple of those. Mr. McDonough reported on Union Depot. Rochester Zip Rail has received a good deal of the funding for their environmental studies. MTI in Minneapolis, several million for the development of the MTI station. And NLX has benefited greatly from those past dollars, predominantly for completion of the environmental work on the project, and now moving ahead into the engineering phase of the project. We're calling it preliminary engineering. The bond dollars that we received, about $3 million, have gone to match $6 million in federal funding. So it's about a 2-to-1. And we're progressing NLX on the engineering level now, not just the environmental study level. It's kind of a big step for us. We're very excited about it. We'll start working with actual design, particularly with some of the stations along the way. We're planning in Coon Rapids, Cambridge, Hinckley, Duluth, and it's moving ahead. And without the help from that former bond appropriation and the one that we're suggesting in this legislation, passenger rail in the state would really diminish. And we're here to support that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions of our testifier from Duluth? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would be remiss if I didn't recognize Mr. Now you said it, now I can't say it. John Argara, who also serves with us on the Midwest Interstate Passenger Rail Commission. I see him sitting in the dark, and it dawned on me that he's also serves on that with Mr. Crom and myself. So that's
Thank
all.
You. And I also wanted to welcome to our committee, we have another class of 7th grade students from Dodge Middle School, I believe. So, and as I said to the class over here, we're just wrapping up some testimony on a bill to promote more passenger trains, passenger rail, in the state of Minnesota. So that's on the topic today. And we have one of our members from Hermantown, Minnesota, near Duluth, presenting the bill, Representative Murphy. And Representative Murphy, do you have any final thoughts? I don't see any more questions from the committee. So anything you want to? Oh, yes, we do. Okay. Representative O'Neill.
It wouldn't be a day if I didn't ask a question.
That's right. You've been unusually quiet today.
I know. Thank you, Chair. Just can you help me understand some of the history in the background? I understand that there had been a passenger rail line from the metro up to Duluth, and then it was abandoned. Can you speak to why it was established, why it failed, and why we're looking at doing it again?
Well,
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, it was part of the original Amtrak. As a child, I remember the trains coming into Duluth on a regular basis, several trains a day carrying passengers into Duluth. And that was a long time ago. And then Willard Munger was a representative of the House of Representatives for he's the longest serving representative in history. And he was a motivator of rail transportation from Duluth. And after his death, the train kind of died too, more because of the time. It became almost quicker to drive than to ride the train with all the stops that the train made between the cities and Duluth. And so economically, we couldn't generate the federal matches and the state interest. But areas, people started to cooperate. And that's where we've gotten to this point of cooperation to have rail, some kind of rail service throughout the whole state. But certainly Mr. Mazzolin could talk about that in more detail than I can. But I think it's a good thing to have choices.
Mr. Mazzolin, do you want to add to Representative Murphy's historical account of the rise and fall of the Duluth Amtrak service?
Very quickly, Mr. Chair and Representative. The Amtrak service ended in 1987, and it was a fairly slow, cumbersome train ride, 3.5 to 4.5 hours from Minneapolis to Duluth. And it really did fail because it did not compete with the automobile. Back in 2001, actually, we went and looked at why that system failed and what we could do to reverse it and make people want to ride the train. And we've done a lot of work to establish a route now that would travel at speeds of 90 and for short distances 110 miles an hour and get between Duluth and Minneapolis in just over 2 hours, 2 hours and 15 minutes, which is competitive with the automobile with 4 stops along the way. So we know that we have to compete with the automobile. We have to get there quicker. particularly on a day like today, you can get there a lot faster. And that's, we've learned from the past, and we're moving into the present and future.
Representative O'Neill, thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Chair. I guess I'm still not quite understanding the why. I live in Buffalo, and it took me 3 hours to drive in today. I get that on a day like today, if I was coming from Duluth, I'd probably want to get on the train because driving would be horrendous, probably be a 10-hour drive or something horrible. I don't know how long it took you, but it took me 3 hours to get in just from Buffalo, and I had to divert and divert and divert to try to get here. My question is, you know, I'm just trying to understand why there is a great desire to go back and forth between that. We've got the interstate, which is, unless a day like today, works pretty well. It's an incredibly expensive endeavor to do passenger rail. Is there, you know, a great demand to go from Duluth down here? It's, you know, best case scenario, it's over 2 hours of travel from Duluth to the metro. I'm just trying to understand, you know, obviously you're not going to live in Duluth and work in the Twin Cities, so I'm trying to understand what would be the desire to have a train to go there back and forth.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we could spend the rest of the morning discussing this, I believe, but there's a lot of reasons. The studies that have been performed so far, we look at the traffic on Highway 35 itself right now, heading toward Duluth between here and Hinckley, for example, well over 24,000 cars a day, and then up to Duluth. And we look at the passenger rail system and how many people would go from the automobile to the train. And what we're seeing right now is to make the train successful, it would only need to take about 5 to 10% of those auto travelers and put them onto the train. It's not a lot of travelers you might think would be needed to make a system like this successful. And a lot of folks do need another option for transportation. There's a lot of need, we believe, for that train service, and what we're seeing so far is that the ridership numbers justify the costs of operation. They might not justify the cost of construction. The construction would be a capital cost not covered by the ridership revenues. The infrastructure would be constructed primarily with public dollars, and then when the operation occurs, those operational costs would be covered by revenue fares. And it's right now it's about a break even on NLX is what we're seeing. And am I answering your question?
No.
No?
But may I ask a follow-up to maybe
sure,
drill down a little bit deeper? You know, again, I just don't see people living in Duluth and trying to drive, you know, take the train into the metro to work. I could see people maybe going along that route to go to the casino. So are we doing this so that people can get to the casino in Hinckley? I just don't understand. Other than maybe going to visit Duluth for the weekend or something, I'm just trying to justify this huge expenditure, like you said, of capital investment, so people can go to a casino or could go to Duluth for the weekend. I mean, we're not talking about people living in Duluth and coming to the Twin Cities because you haven't said that. I don't understand why would we want to do this and spend so much money. I mean, how much is it for the capital investment?
Right now, Mr.
Proceed.
About $700 million for the capital.
So $700 million so that people could go to the casino and go to Duluth for the weekend? I don't see the justification.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative, if you look at the ridership numbers, again, we have four stations along the line in Coon Rapids, in Cambridge, Hinckley, and Duluth. And right now, the studies are telling us two-thirds of the ridership will occur between Hinckley and Minneapolis. And it will actually serve more like a transit system from Hinckley on south. North to Duluth, though, using the existing track, 90-mile-per-hour service, the cost for constructing that segment isn't as costly as the southerly portion of the line. And the numbers, again, we're not looking at, we're looking at how much ridership will we take off the highway and put on the train. And our numbers are very low. Again, it's in the 5 to 10% range. Will that many people riding on the highway today select or to use the train? And we're right now finding out the numbers are good, and we think they will. It's only 1 out of 10 cars. Would you rather take the train or would you rather drive? and it's saying, yes, they would.
You know, I...
Final,
thank you, Chair. You know, I had our research do a little number crunching for me because I love to look at the numbers, and the amount riding, you know, 5% was pretty much the, if you look at the overall ridership in totality of everything of the system in the metro, is about 5%, looked like was transit to me, but maybe I looked at it wrong, but I just see this 5 to 10% is a pretty high number. That's a pretty high bar. But my question, my last question is to me it sounds like the major attraction here is going to the casino. I mean, that's what's in Hinckley. So is the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe considering partnering with the state of Minnesota, a private-public partnership, to so they can have a rail lineup to their casino?
Mr. Representative, we are working with the casino right now to look at a new station in the casino area. But I think you need to know, we're getting more detail about, you know, what we've learned. And in Duluth, there's over 1 million visitors every year going to the city of Duluth for vacation and whatever. The Tourism Bureau has, you know, come up with those numbers. And I think there's a lot more travel going on in that corridor that you might not be aware of.
Enlighten me.
Visitorship in Duluth, the casino, Hinckley area right. Is almost like putting a population center of 500,000 right along that corridor. So, yes, there will be a lot of folks visiting the casino. The line will serve as a commuter. The folks in Cambridge are very excited about this project. There's been overwhelming support in Cambridge for their transit into Minneapolis. It's been supported along the way. The numbers are justifying themselves, and we're moving ahead.
And do you have those numbers?
I can get those for you.
Thank you. I'd like those.
Yeah. We'll take two more questions and comments. Representative Hausman, and we'll give...
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it is important to talk about demographic changes. And we know that in greater Minnesota, the population is aging, absolutely. And that is a population that's looking for transportation alternatives in a way that they haven't before. It is a very, that is a measurable change in the state. And we certainly hear that, that they're looking for alternatives. The other thing is what's happening in Duluth. UMD, and I believe this it was true last year, I'm assuming it is still true, is the fastest growing part of the University of Minnesota. That demographic is also changing. I think we may have talked about this the other day. I forget what committee I'm in when we talk about this, but we used to think of the car as freedom, and this this new generation thinks of it as the opposite, as not having a car is freedom, and they do look at walking and biking and public mass transit and intercity passenger rail as desirable, and so that growing population, both from those who are aging and those who are going to college, they are going to change the kind of infrastructure we have to invest in, and I think that's what happens here. I think the other thing, when we hear that price tag, I do think we have to think about the investment in rail and rolling stock is a 100-year investment. I mean, we are building for the future, and when you build transportation infrastructure, you have to sort of look out that far sometimes when you measure these investments. So I just think those are helpful additional comments.
And Mr. Chair, to add on.
Representative Murphy.
To add on to what Representative Hausman was saying, it's not just the University of Minnesota that's growing, it's the College of St. Scholastica that's growing, it's Lake Superior College that's also growing, and getting students from the Twin City area that could use the train going north. And we don't expect that the train would stop at Duluth, because Mr. Mazzolini said he represents St. Louis County and Lake County Rail Authority. And my county, my portion of Lake County is Two Harbors and the area before you get to Two Harbors. But I think that's an important thing in that they, too, and the Iron Range communities are thinking about how this could benefit people opening the door to coming north further at some point in time, maybe in the third 100 years.
We have two more, and then I would like to wrap up the hearing. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the author. Some of this was asked and answered by Representative Hausman already, but the colleges up there, could we be provided with the numbers of out-of-area students that could potentially use that rail system, and could we also get some numbers from the Chamber of Commerce as to the tourism traffic that could be generated to the city of Duluth as well. As we prioritize this, all these measures, those would be good numbers to have.
Thank you. And, of course, this will be, you know, as we discuss this, it's a bonding proposal. We'll make sure that, and we'll talk with Representative Hausman about the proper timeline for us to do this ranking. It'll be soon. And we'll hopefully get all the information that members still seem to need about this proposal in your hands. I saw, yes, somebody, I saw a hand somewhere. Was that? Right. Oh, okay, Representative Beard.
Yeah, just to correctify a situation or a comment that we just made, railroads are not 100-year investments. In the freight world, members, FRA requires freight cars to be destroyed every 40 years. I think passenger cars may have a shorter lifespan, but Mr. Crom could probably correct me on that. Members, the investment to get it up and running is the initial investment, and then you constantly have to renew and rebuild, especially when you get above 110 miles an hour into Class 5 and Class 6 track. You replace ties and rails routinely every couple of years. I just want to make sure we understood that the right-of-way might be a 100-year right-of-way, but the investment in the capital equipment itself actually is constantly being renewed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, okay, folks in Dodge Middle School, that's going to be on the test. How often do you need to replace a rail car? So that's, you just want to pay attention. A lot of these things on the test, so hope you're paying attention. Just kidding. Looking at the teacher, right? I wanted to thank the committee. You know, this was a great discussion. We didn't really have, I think, a thorough, we had a little bit of overview from MnDOT about passenger rail when they were giving their general overview, but this actually, I think, provided, this hearing, Representative Murphy, provided the committee with a lot more information about passenger rail. So this was really helpful. That's why we went almost 45 minutes, I think, on this. So I really appreciate your bringing this to our attention. I don't know if you or any of your testifiers want one final comment. Otherwise, we'll move on to our last bill.
I think we all learned today.
Thank you. Coming from a teacher, that's
yes.
A good thing. Okay, members, so... So members, again, to remind you, House File 793 will be on our docket for consideration as a ranked bill for our bonding bill. It's a Representative Hausman. So with that, this bill is now completed, our informational hearing. We have one last one. Hopefully it's not as controversial. I've presented this one before, and you know, we'll hopefully even potentially end early. But please be kind to Vice Chair Bernardi as she oversees her very first, her maiden voyage as the chair of the Transportation Finance Committee.
Did you bring your mason to work?
When the first time you chair a committee, does he have to bring candy?
Mark, we're just going to do a casino run.
Is it so?
It would be $750 million for casino run.
Well, welcome, Chair Hornstein, to the Transportation Finance Committee. We'd like to give you a warm welcome. And this is for those of you, I'm sure, that are just getting here or just got here, that this it's the custom of this committee for the last 10 years to provide information and get review these bills and rank the various proposals, and then we will bring them forward and recommend those to the bonding committee for with Representative Hausman. So, Representative Hornstein, as you know, it's good to follow up with members after the committee to
sure.
make sure yours ranks the top. Yeah. And this is your time to shine now, Mr. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Vice Chair Bernardi, and you know, members, I do sometimes on the side impressions, impersonations, and that was a very, I'm now feeling like a little comeuppance here. So, anyway, members, this is a bill that Representative Beard heard last year, and I think I've been bringing on a fairly regular basis. And this relates to a storm tunnel project in I-35W, which is actually a little bit closer to the area I used to represent before redistricting, but still very close to my district. And of course, I-35W is the most heavily traveled corridor south of downtown towards Lakeville in the region, both for automobiles and public transit. So it's always good to get our infrastructure for this corridor up to our standards. And so I have just one testifier today. And that's Ms. Cherney, Lisa Cherney from the City of Minneapolis Public Works. So she'll just walk you through a brief PowerPoint, and then I think both of us would be happy to answer your questions.
Good morning. My name is Lisa Cherney. I'm the Director of Surface Water and Sewers for the City of Minneapolis in the Public Works Department. We're having a couple of technical challenges, but so I'll get started because the packet is in your information. So if you look on the bottom left corner of the first slide, that is the outfall for the 35W South Tunnel underneath the new 35W bridge. The lower right-hand corner shows the 35W North Tunnel. And the reason the difference is north-south, south is on the south side of the Mississippi River, the north is on the north side. I'm going to also give you a little bit of history on this specific infrastructure. So these are deep storm tunnels in the City of Minneapolis that drain both Midtown right-of-way as well as City right-of-way. They are roughly 80 to 100 feet below the surface, running in the 35W corridor. They're built in a sandstone layer below a bedrock layer. They are built of concrete. They range in diameter between 8 and 14 feet. The 35W North Tunnel is roughly 1.8 miles in length, and the 35W South Tunnel is roughly 4.7 miles. Just going to pause here one quick second to catch up, and then you can see on your screens as well. So the 35W North Tunnel on the north side of the Mississippi River, that was built to accommodate the 35W drainage in the MnDOT right-of-way, as well as there was a significant portion north of that area that historically drained to the sanitary system. And so we were not, in our current system, we didn't have the capacity for that. So at the time of the freeway, the city also then disconnected that storm from the sanitary, which was part of our combined sewer overflow initiative that has been going on for many years. The 35W South Tunnel is a bit different. The drainage went from the west side of the freeway all the way over to the Mississippi River. The 35W corridor is down in a trench, and that disrupted that flow, and so the 35W tunnel had to accommodate that drainage as well. Our current bonding request is for $4.5 million of state bonds, as well as $4.5 million local match. The local match is coming out of our Stormwater Utility Enterprise Fund in the City of Minneapolis. The types of deficiencies that we would address with this funding, the top left, it shows groundwater. Again, because you're down that far below the earth, there is oftentimes groundwater, and so when there are holes or cracks in the tunnel, groundwater is coming into the tunnel. choosing a path of least resistance. And with it, oftentimes, because it's built in a sandstone layer, it's bringing sand. And therefore, it's creating voids behind the tunnel, which when the tunnel pressurizes, it no longer has that pressure to keep it, the outside forces to keep it together. Another type is a longitudinal crack. So that's the linear length of the tunnel. What happens if you get too many of those, or if they're in the right place, again, when the tunnel pressurizes, that top portion of the tunnel can lift up and again allow a significant amount of sand to come in, creating larger voids. The bottom left is actually one of the voids that's on top of a tunnel. So you can obviously see that there's a fair amount of sand that's come out of from around those tunnels. There's holes, and then there's liner failures. So those are the types of defects that we have. What would we do? First of all, you got to get the sand, the sediment out of the tunnel. So that's a first step. Then you go in there and you fill, and sometimes you have to take off the entire top liner and reconnect it to the existing. You have to rebuild that tunnel. Sometimes you can go in there and you can put material on the outside of the tunnel to fill those voids. But you have to fill the cracks, fill the voids, seal them, and do some grouting. Our request is so that we can manage this condition before it becomes a larger safety issue. The city of Minneapolis does still need to continue to remove water from our sanitary system, and we need a place to put it. That place to put it is our stormwater system. The stormwater system needs to be in good condition. And the combined sewer overflow permit requires that. Metropolitan Council Environmental Services also has what's known as an inflow and infiltration program, where they're trying to remove clear water out of the system and keep that space for wastewater. We have been working with MnDOT, and we'll continue to be working with MnDOT, and they do support our request. With that, I will stand for questions and appreciate your time.
Well, thank you to our testifier and to Chair Hornstein. My family, when we go through these bridges, we see if we can hold our breath. And I now realize that we probably do need to hold our breath if we don't make these upgrades and repairs. So it'll be a different kind of holding our breath now. But I want to know, we have a question from our esteemed Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to switch subjects on you since you're an expert in sewers. I have been reading in the newspaper that the sanitary system under Minneapolis is in terrible shape as well. Can you comment on that? Which is even more important to me than the stormwater.
I can comment in general. Much of the sanitary, the big lines through the city of Minneapolis are actually Met Council interceptors, and that is what carries the regional flow to the treatment plant in St. Paul. But are they in terrible condition? I mean, much of our infrastructure is of a significant age, and it does need to be maintained and repaired and monitored.
But
and we have been continuing to do that on our
system. Madam Chair, you don't have anything to do with that. Or just for the day you're talking about stormwater, I understand, for the corridor because of transportation. But in general, do you also monitor your area of expertise, also monitor the sanitary sewers?
Ms. Cerny.
Yes, my area is for the city of Minneapolis. Yes. It is responsible for both the storm system as well as the sanitary system, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hornstein, for this. A question in regards to just the stormwater, is that all water that just comes from Highway 35, or is that surrounding area as well? And is that, do we have the percentage of Minneapolis and St. Paul and others that are using it as a, or whatever town it is, their fair share of the cost of this?
Yes, we do have a breakout of the split. On the 35W South Tunnel, there is approximately 15% of the drainage is MnDOT right-of-way, and the remainder is the city of Minneapolis. The 35W North Tunnel is, I I don't remember that number off the top of my head, but again, it's a portion of the flow. A smaller portion of it is MnDOT, and the larger portion is, I'm sorry, it is on the slide. 62% is, sorry, 62% of 35W North is MnDOT, and then the remainder is, I said that backwards, 62% is Minneapolis, and 32 is MnDOT.
Okay.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and I was just thinking about the void, and I know that there's some sand down in Winona that we probably use for the void. So.
Representative Beard.
Well, thank you.
No comment.
Madam Chair, Mr. Petersburg asked one of my most important questions, but maybe to Ms. Cherney. The bonding request, then, is that a rough approximation about the split between Minneapolis and MnDOT's responsibility for this tunnel? Because this is a very important tunnel for 35W.
Ms. Cherney.
The original construction back in the 60s, at that time, an agreement was signed between the City of Minneapolis and MnDOT. The City of Minneapolis, based on that agreement, has the responsibility for the operations and maintenance of the tunnel. And therefore, the request is a City of Minneapolis request, and the match is a City of Minneapolis dollars.
Madam Chair, thank you for the clarification and for the committee's edification. This is one of the least glamorous bonding requests you'll ever get. There will be no ribbon cutting and no pictures being taken whenever this project is done, but for the safety and security of Interstate 35, this is an important one for us to consider. Thank you.
Any other questions by members? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Just a quick question. My understanding would be then this could be done without disrupting 35 at all, correct? This all be done internally and support.
Ms. Cherney?
That is correct. The way that we repair and maintain the tunnels is through access shafts, drop shafts, manholes. They're very large. They're very deep. But so you take your material up and down through those, and yes, so no vehicular movement would be impacted.
Looks like that concludes our members' questions. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Well, Representative Hornstein, do you have any concluding remarks?
No, thank you very much, members, and I'll have another 35W-related bill later for you, not today. But I appreciate the attention, and also thanks to Ms. Cherney, and hopefully you'll consider this one as well.
Well, thank you, Representative Hornstein and Ms. Cherney. That concludes our informational hearing on House File 378. We will hold it over for ranking and bring that forward to the Bonding Committee and Chair Hausman. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair and members.
And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.